On Sunday, April 2nd, 2006, Brendan Fanning ended his brief no-frills whistle report on Munster's 19-10 quarter-final win over Perpignan for the Observer newspaper with the prophetic sentence, "The build-up will be like no other." He was, of course, referring to the semi-final place that Munster had just booked against Leinster. It was the first of two such semi-final clashes in the Heineken Cup that changed the course of Irish rugby. Today, on the RTE Rugby Podcast, we're going to go for a little voyage, sporting and personal, around the two great blue and red battles of that era. One at the old Lansdowne, just months before its ghosts were slain by the wrecking ball of the Celtic Tiger. One at Croke Park, just as the Tiger was going the way of some of the beasts in the show of the moment, Netflix's Tiger King. Those alive at the time, never mind those that were there, will never forget. Welcome to this edition of the podcast. Hope everyone is coping with the ups and downs of lockdown. It's Darragh O'Brien here, and I'm with Wes Liddy and Bernard Jackman, who played in the second of those famous games. We're going to go for a bit of a wander in the mind for the next half hour or so, using the two biggest ever club games in Irish history as our only signposts. So, Bernard, how old were you, and what were you at in 2006?
Well, I should have been on the pitch. I would like to be on the pitch. I actually joined Leinster in 2005, and I broke my leg in January that season. So I was actually on crutches. The non-selected and injured players' tickets were up at the very top of, I think it was the West Stand. So I remember hobbling up to my seat and not being able to make a fast getaway at the end when I wanted to. I mean, it was a pretty embarrassing day to be associated with Leinster. You know, it was a dark, dark day. I think they call it Black Sunday. That's what we called it anyway. And it probably was fuel for kind of what happened over the next couple of years. But, you know, it was a day being a member of the squad, but not being on the field was very frustrating. And I remember the feeling afterwards of just, I suppose, horrified, humiliated, I think was probably with two words that spring to mind.
Just on, go back, apart from that, of course, you were so close to it, but just put yourself back in your head then. I mean, you were young, we were all young, but like Ireland, I mean, I remember it was just a blazing hot sunny day, and it was 2006, and it was crazy town. The whole country was a bit nuts. It was like, if arguably the high point of what we consider to be our economic renaissance as a nation. And it was just, look, everybody slags it off now, but I suppose 14 years on, we can say there were good times then as well.
Yeah, no, the hype was unbelievable. I mean, everyone felt, I suppose, super confident. We'd watched Munster. I'd started my career in Connacht and Sale, and I'd been really envious of the players who got to play in the Heineken Cup. I've been playing Challenge Cup for most of my career. I actually, along with a load of other Connacht players, went on the ferry to Twickenham for the Munster Northampton final. So to support Munster as such, an Irish team, and obviously Munster at this stage hadn't got the whole way and obviously won the competition. But suddenly then for Leinster to come and potentially win it before them would have been, you know, unbelievable. And I think both sets of fans really started to galvanise. Obviously, I think one of the big shocks of the day was how many people Munster had in the ground compared to Leinster. And certainly as a group, that probably hurt us. Definitely hurt Michael Cheika. And post that, there was a real campaign to try and, I suppose, get the respect of our fans, really. And that sounds ridiculous, because when you lose that badly, and you haven't had a track record of performing like Munster had, it's hard to demand more of your fans. You have to earn that. But definitely we felt, you know, we needed to build up a closer relationship with our fans, and that if it ever came to a stage like that where we played in a knockout game again, you know, that our people would be behind us as much as theirs were.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big, the whole Leinster thing, which is a horrible word, but a very interesting phenomenon. We'll come back to that, because I agree with you. It was a bit like East Germany after the fall of the Iron Curtain. Officially, there was 4 million members of the Communist Party, but they could only find about 1 million, you know. Once the winds changed, everybody changed. And I think the 2009 game, which we'll talk about too, was the last chance to jump the fence with any credibility. And a lot of people did, because as you said, it was 50-50 in Croke Park that day, as opposed to probably 3-1 in Lansdowne in 06.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like I'm from Tullow, so, you know, a lot of people, neighbours of mine, would have been Munster fans, you know. I remember we went on a Christmas party to Kilkenny, which is in Leinster, and we nearly got abused. I mean, I know that Kilkenny had strong links with Munster, with obviously Mick Galway,
Willie Duggan, yeah.
And Dowling. Yeah, Willie Duggan, Dowling the winger. But it was like we went to Limerick, you know, the hatred towards us. So, look, there's lots of different things that kind of are part of a journey of a team, and particularly a team like Leinster who are underperforming. But I think probably Munster's success and Munster, the amount of Munster were loved by people, definitely made us envious of it, and was definitely, as I said, a driver or a fuel. But that day, I mean, that day was a horrible day to be part of Leinster rugby. I mean, we just couldn't do anything right on the field. And again, you have to understand, it's coming off the back of what was a phenomenal away win and Toulouse. And, you know, even though Leinster had a lot of high-profile failures previous to this in European games, even when they had a favourable draw, etc., they seemed to underperform at the wrong time. But definitely in 2006, there was a feeling that, you know, the team were maturing. There's some young talent like Heaslip coming through, etc., that maybe that was our time. But unfortunately, our culture and our environment probably wasn't strong enough to
and definitely we want to go back to that, the whole cultural thing. And the Kilkenny point is very interesting, because I remember there was almost like a choice between identities as an Irish sports and rugby supporter. Like, you had Munster that seemed to represent almost like GAA values. We were the, you know, the kind of no nonsense, no frills, straight talking down the line. Whereas, and we see echoes of it now with the kind of cultural backlash against private school culture in rugby. Leinster seemed to represent that kind of more flimsy, coiffed, kind of manicured product of Irish malehood. Now, all of these were massive cliches and generalizations, but they did feed in. But let me go back, Wes, to that day that Munster played Perpignan in the semi-final there that I referred to at the top, because I remember being in Smith's Pub in Haddington Road, which we all know, and watching the tail end of the Leinster-Toulouse game that Bert referenced. And that was unbelievable. That was just one of the great games. And it was only an hour later that the Perpignan game kicked off. So we left the pub and went down to that match. And everybody was still kind of buzzing from the fact that Leinster had pulled off the most unlikely of victories. And to me, the scene was set then for Munster to be underdogs, which was massive, considering the pedigree in the tournament had been much stronger in Munster's favour. But all of a sudden, because of that Toulouse win, Leinster went into the Lansdowne game as small favourites, but favourites nonetheless.
Yeah, I remember watching the Perpignan, like I was still living in Limerick at the time, but I was up for the game, obviously, the Perpignan one, and watching it in one of the pubs in, I can't remember which one even, but one of the pubs in Ball's Bridge before heading over to the stadium. And it was still the innocent days for a couple of more weeks where you were justified in cheering on another Irish team, but I was way too bitter for that. So I was cheering for Toulouse, obviously, but probably more out of fear that you could possibly lose to Leinster in the semi-final. I could have lived with losing to Toulouse a lot easier, but they were brilliant, obviously, against Toulouse. And I suppose Munster's flaw always had been that, you know, they didn't have that cutting edge, or that bit extra was always the talk once you got past the kind of numbers 1-10. And then you saw this Leinster backline tearing apart the kind of aristocrats of European rugby on French style. And you kind of went, geez, we could be in trouble here. But in hindsight, when you look back at it, a lot of players in that Leinster team, greatest to respect them, were being completely overhyped on the back of that Toulouse game as well. I mean, when you look through the 15 now and you see Blaney at hooker and Cameron Jowett at blindside and selections like this, and you're kind of going, no, they weren't anywhere near as good as their counterparts on the other team. So I think it was very much kind of as good as Leinster were playing, if we were to go into that old cliche of kind of forwards winning matches, maybe we were all a little unduly worried about Munster's prospects before the game in some ways, you know, and that's how it unfolded, I suppose.
Yeah, but there was the fatalism too from a Munster perspective that they'd fallen so heartbreakingly so often. It was just like the man above had his remote control and he was going, right, I'm going to teach you another lesson now by not alone chucking you out at a semi-final stage, but letting Leinster chuck you out. Right. And of course, it didn't take long, Bernard, when the whistle blew for Mallow Kelly to put us all back in a better mood.
Well, put you back in a better mood, maybe, but Munster fans. But I looked back at the game yesterday in preparation for this. I actually hadn't seen it since, I think, probably the match review that week. I haven't looked at 2009 either, but I looked at both yesterday. But yeah, from the kickoff, so Raj puts an unbelievable kickoff that has Mal going backwards. It's just going to land just outside of 22, which is kind of a no man's land in terms of where, you know, it also depends in terms of where we set up. So it's a really difficult one. Is it Mal's going back or is it Gervin's coming forward? And Mal goes up for it, doesn't catch it, and straight away they get field position. And looking back at that game, I mean, the first 20 minutes we couldn't get out of our own half. And then we started to, our line-out was really poor. Obviously, we missed touch from a penalty that we got a bit of possession after. We got a turnover after about 7 or 8 minutes. We missed touch and Sean Payne bangs it back into our half again and we lost the line out again. So it was back-to-back errors, but just the pressure from Munster. And then we started to panic, started running out of our own 22. And I mean, there was one stage where Dennis Hickey nearly got away down the left wing, but gets put in touch and Munster have the ball again. And Rogers kicking. Well, Rogers kicking, you know, was a given to be, that was going to be good, but
yeah,
he absolutely destroyed us. But also, I thought his passing game, when I look back on it, yesterday, I mean, we were kind of a drift defence off set piece, and he was playing really flat and putting, you know, real weight on his passes, and they were getting over the gain line, and there was loads of niggle as well, and I don't think, you know, we didn't really react well to that. We definitely, the Munster won that battle. Leamy was immense. Axel was playing. You know, Dowling was coming in, pushing and shoving. It was just like, when you watch it back, it makes you sick, to be honest. What we let them get away with, but they were dominant. You know, they won the game hands down on the scoreboard and in terms of the moment. So there was a lot to be learned from it, to be honest, in terms of what you need to do to beat Munster, and you can't take a backward step. And unfortunately, we took a lot of backward steps.
Did Rog miss a kick that day? Because I knew he was 5 out of 5 in the quarterfinal, Wes, and I think he was 100% in the final too. I can't remember. Did he miss one? He was at peak form. He was at his peak, though.
Well, there was even one passage where he ran the ball out from his own 22 sidestep. I think it was Dennis Hickey who was chasing up the kick, linked with John Kelly. So it was like, it was like Munster were being a little bit emboldened, even in attack, to play a little bit beyond what we'd seen from him, maybe. It was kind of one of those days where everything you hoped could possibly go for you went, and everything that you thought could go wrong for the opposition went for them. But funny, Bernard obviously mentioned Axel there, and I remember, like, watching it in hindsight and all the DVDs and stuff that came out afterwards after the trophy was won, like, the face on Axel coming out of the dressing room. They had cameras in the tunnel as both teams were coming out. I remember Rob Henderson talking. He was a sub, and he was looking across at Emmett Byrne, who was a sub for Leinster, and he saw Axel coming out with this kind of face like thunder on him, and the two boys were looking across at each other, kind of giggling almost, kind of saying, Jesus, this will be a tasty one now, that it was just... I think Munster just got to a totally different place mentally than even they were used to getting to that day. And I don't know what Bernard would say, but maybe Leinster didn't quite get there or didn't know what was coming in that kind of way, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And like, we probably thought, a replica of the performance against Toulouse was going to be good enough. It was in our own backyard. It was effectively a home game in theory for us. And you know, we had the backs. This is all probably how we felt, that we had the back line to do damage. But I mean, we couldn't. I mean, that kick that so Felipe Contepone, we actually weren't far behind. I think we were 10-3 down, and we had a penalty. Felipe doesn't kick it a touch. He goes long, because I think John Kelly was out of position and gives Dennis a chance to chase him. Dennis chased John, chased John Kelly. John Kelly got back up again and passed to Rog. And Rog was like a matador. I mean, he ran out of his own 22, and we missed tackles. And the next thing, they kicked it back down the field. And it was just one of those moments where you go, like,
Olé!
But Rog shouldn't be doing this. We should be trapping them back in their 22. Like, every small moment went their way, not because of luck, but just because they seemed to be at a completely different level. And just talking about Axel, I mean, I was lucky enough to know Axel. Like, can you imagine Axel worried about Leinster being the first team to win a Highland Cup, given everything he had done in a Munster jersey and part of that? Like, there's no doubt that they were absolutely, totally on a different level mentally, and he would have played a huge role in that. He couldn't countenance losing to us that day, and the fear, and he, like, in fairness to him, he was very conscious, and he often used he had a chip on his shoulder, and he often used any kind of worry about being written off or being hard done by. And I mean, for given what Munster had done in Europe over the previous 10-12 years and the role he played in that, I mean, there was no chance that they weren't going to be ready for it. But unfortunately, we weren't. You know, we weren't ready for it at all.
I think Contepomi actually is an interesting one just as well. I mean, obviously, he's a pivotal character in those games during that run of maybe 05 to 09 in terms of for both sides. But like, he was probably man of the match for Munster that way. That day, he just completely imploded. And I suppose you didn't put it in words at the time, but when you were drawn on all these cliches to kind of define the difference in the two teams and the difference in the supporters and stuff, I suppose it was a little bit of kind of bemusement at how he was so loved by the Leinster support, yet he was so obviously flimsy and targetable. It was a bizarre kind of character in the whole drama.
Look at that. Yeah, I think again he's probably he was a key guy in the Munster Leinster rivalry and hatred. I mean, he was very open about how much he didn't like Munster, and
the future.
Absolutely, and they got to him. I mean, there's another moment in that game. So Felipe didn't have a good game. His base kicking was poor. His line kicking was poor. He nothing went right for him. But we actually started to get a bit of possession and a bit of territory after about 25 minutes. And next thing, it gets called back for a penalty against us because him and Leamy were fighting on the ground just inside 22.
Yeah.
Leams was brilliant. Leams, Quinny, Axel, they all really got to Felipe. But in that game, in front of 42 or 3,000 people, he seemed to implode massively. And but having said that, when you played with Felipe, I mean, you tolerated that kind of odd breakdown because he was gifted. And when you gave him a good platform, he could rip teams apart. Unfortunately, I think as a team, we let him down that day, and that we gave him a terrible platform, and we kind of let Munster isolate him and get to him. Whereas I think in 2009, I know he didn't finish the game. He went off quite early, but he seemed to have matured. And we, I think, gave him a better platform as well. But the pack let him down that day, and Munster got to him. And I mean, it was, when you compare Rogers' performance, it's probably a 10 out of 10. You know, I think Felipe's is probably a 3 out of 10. And you can't have that kind of difference at 10.
But this is the interesting thing about why I suppose these games were so important, and it's easy fitting narratives on after the event, as we all know. But didn't Felipe go on to play some of his best rugby, both for Argentina and for Leinster afterwards? And you'd be tempted to think that was just like he was absolutely scorched so badly he went and improved again. You know, the old story about Rog, was it on the 2001 Lions, looking at Johnny Wilkinson and going, Christ, I have a long way to go if I'm going to be top. And you know, there are moments in a player's career, whether they're matches or our personal experiences, that make them dig even deeper. And I guess that was like, you know, it took 2 or 3 years to come to fruition. But the pain of that, Birch, and the pain of walking around Dublin after that, when Dublin was, that day was just, I don't know, was it 25 degrees? But it seemed to be, in my feverish middle-aged memory, looking back in it now, it was just popping. The colours everywhere were popping, and they were mostly red. and it was sunny and people were on the streets and there was, I mean, there was no aggro, of course, because that wasn't the way of it, but there was just this feeling of kind of carnival that Munster people had come to Dublin and showed Dubliners and Munster and Leinster people that really they were only renting the city, that it belonged to the rest of us. I mean, it was fantastic. Of course, it's all mythic, but yeah, I mean, I'd say you got an absolute scorching.
Yeah, no, we did, but I like just about Felipe. I mean, I think in fairness to him, that was probably, I think he is a mentally strong player and he had massive performances in big games at World Cups, etc., for Argentina and for us. But that day, it all went pear-shaped. And again, I don't blame him. I think maybe he got overly hyped up about it and he saw the opportunity or felt the need to maybe beat Munster on his own right. Or that he had to pull something out of the bag where we just weren't really tight enough as a team to alleviate that pressure. But again, it's a fascinating subplot in the rivalry. I mean, you know, you had an Argentinian who probably was the most, who showed the most emotion and most hatred of your biggest rival. You know what I mean? It shouldn't necessarily be your foreign import. It should be one of your own, really. But that's just the way. It's just that's the way it was. I mean, it was Felipe against Munster more so than a united team against Munster. But he, in fairness to him, he was great. And like as a teammate of his, you tolerated that petulance sometimes because he was a bit of a maverick and a genius.
Oh, we all. It doesn't matter now. Like, of course. I mean, nobody who's any head on their shoulders wouldn't admire him. I remember interviewing him years later and throwing in the Rog question to him, expecting the usual kind of well-brought-up Irish boy who'd say, oh, well, what happens on the field stays on the field. But no, he was like, yeah, I don't like him. He has a big lip. Which was great for a journalist because he was telling the truth.
Yeah, it could be, yeah. But the sledging in those games.
Sorry, you can see he's one of those characters that even when they're supporting the opposition, you can see he's one of those guys. If he was on your team, you'd love him. Yeah. And he's equally one of the guys that when he's on an opposition, he's just a lightning rod for the opposition supporters. And in fairness, that Munster team was full of those kind of players. Like Leamy as well, I'd imagine, was hated amongst Leinster fans at the time.
Go on about the sledging there, Bart.
No, but just like the amount of talk. look, we all knew each other too well. Effectively, you go into Irish camp, you know, there's 40 players in Irish camp. Effectively, 30 of them were coming from Leinster and Munster over that period of 4 or 5 years. So you were competing with them for an international jersey. You were competing with them at a provincial level, whether it's in the Magnus League or for Europe. A lot of them, you know, you played maybe Irish in the 20s or Irish schools with or whatever. It was just unbelievable. And I remember when I was in Connacht, you'd go into camp with Ireland and you sit down for your dinner on the Sunday night or whatever. And like the Munster players, they never talk about Munster. I mean, if Axel was on the table, they never give anything away. And then maybe you sit down with some of the Leinster players and they'd be giving out about this, that and the other. You know, it wasn't the same harmony. But eventually then we became like that and, you know, we were very proud of what we were about and, you know, we'd hate to hear, we would never tolerate anyone from within basically giving away any secrets. But when it came to match day then, I mean, just any little battle you won, you weren't happy with winning that battle in terms of whether, you know, you won a collision or you won a penalty, you felt you had to give them an earful as well. Now, it didn't really pick up on any of the ref mics, but it was unbelievable. I mean, it was non-stop, you know, and it wasn't just Rog or Leamy. It was from our side as well. And it just became a running battle. And if someone got you, you know, if someone gave you a good one-liner, you nearly have to wait maybe a year to fucking try and get them back. But you had to be on the front foot. You know, if you're losing the game, you're losing all the battles. I mean, it's not the same impact. And in that game, 2006, you know, and lots of times, in fairness, Munster were on the front foot. So you had to sometimes suck it up and wait for an opportunity.
And did you find that the men from the south were more quick-witted than your teammates?
I think it was probably a bigger part of the club game down there, to be honest. You know what I mean? I'm sure like the rivalry in Limerick between the Munster clubs, the Munster Senior Cup, the AIL back in the heyday. I mean, these lads, they were living next door to each other, yet they were massive rivals. So I think it probably stemmed from that to a certain extent. You know, I remember, in fairness, it's nothing to do with that game, but like I played Irish colleges with O'Connell. We went on tour to South Africa in 98 or 99, but I was playing in Thomond Park for Leinster. I did 2005, and I got caught the wrong side of a ruck, and I was getting absolutely chewed with an inch of my life. The whole Munster pack seemed to be jumping up and down on me. I genuinely was trapped, and I wasn't even slowing down the ball. And I just heard O'Connell, who would have only been about, but he would have been like early enough in his career. He's had enough, lads, and then everything just stops. You know what I mean? No more stamping, which is a surreal moment in a packed stadium where you can hear him. He's had enough, and then he just stops. Like, just little things like that were part of kind of, it wouldn't happen in another game. He wouldn't get stamped as much, obviously, against another opposition, but also they wouldn't stop. So there was plenty of respect as well. But it was just on the pitch, those games, the amount of sledging and importance of the whole thing was massive. So that photograph of Sexton and O'Gara in 2009, okay, it looks really bad. But in the context of the moments over every match, there would have been plenty of incidents like that, you know, where someone's having a go at an opposition.
Yeah, yeah. Don't worry, we'll get to 2009, yeah. But stay where you are now for a while.
Yeah, you're going to have to suck it up for a few minutes there, Paul.
Come on. Half an hour gone.
But isn't that a great story? I'd never heard that, Bernard, before, because, like, on the one hand, you're going, yeah, and it was very kind of, like, it displays so much about Paul's stature and all the rest of it. But on the other hand, you must have been, I don't need you to tell me when I've had enough. Like,
yeah,
you know?
To be honest, it was an ultimate embarrassment that I would have preferred to get chewed for a bit longer. But like, you don't want any favors either. But no, fair. It's testament to him that he had that in him. But again, you know, it's also not great that you're stuck on the other side of the ruck, and you're relying on them to show you a bit of leniency.
Bit of mercy, yeah.
Yeah.
And look, I mean, we're looking into 2007. It didn't happen for Munster, and you know, but it was still kind of on the bubble. But 2008, to me, if we're kind of moving ahead, was the season. I remember, again, that was a big season for Leinster. They knew they weren't going to win in Europe. We all know that Munster destroyed the Ospreys towards the end of it. Before the second match. But 2008 was a big one. 2008-09, because that was the season, Bernard, that... It was 2007-08 that you won the Magners League, or as it was, I think it had just been christened. And I remember being in Strady Park? You went and needed an away win there, second or third match towards the end. It was before the kind of playoff scene. And remember thinking that Leinster had suddenly kind of, behind the scenes, they must have been working so hard, because they were just beginning to win dirty games. And you kind of sensed that they were so hurt by the reputation as being a soft touch and by being too fancy and all the rest of it. It turned in 2007-08 then, didn't it? For Leinster.
We obviously had to dust ourselves down and try and figure out why we consistently underperformed at the biggest level. Or the Toulouse game away, we played great rugby, but over the previous 10 years, Leinster had always been capable of playing great rugby. But what we didn't really have was a pack who could go toe-to-toe with the opposition. We didn't have a very solid defence, and we didn't really have a tight enough team either, in terms of understanding what playing for Leinster really meant and sacrificing enough in pre-season and training and on match days particularly to go that extra mile to try and win with your teammates. So Cheka, in fairness, I think we learned from 2006, and he started to become very ruthless with the squad, in terms of, if you weren't that type of person who was mentally tough or resilient, you were no good to him. So he weeded out some people who were talented, but maybe just didn't have that level of consistency in them or buy into what he wanted to do. And win the Magners League for us was important. I think it was important to show we could finish off a job in one aspect, but also I think it was important because it gave him time to stay. Because I don't know if he hadn't won something in 2008, maybe Leinster branch would have looked to change a coach again. And then you restart the whole cycle. So just winning that trophy gave us a little bit of security that we had another year under the same coaches. Mike Brewer came in, had come in post 2006 on a full-time basis to work with a forward pack. We developed, Leo came back and Shane Jennings came back from Leicester. Like we used to, our job as forwards was to give the ball to the backs in Leinster. Whereas when Brewer got more power in the coaching setup, and when Leo and Jennings came back, you know, we realised that sometimes the forwards need to be given the opportunity to go toe-to-toe with the opposition for a while and not just be there as servants to the back line. And obviously with the back line we had, that was always going to be difficult. But there was definitely a swing. There was a massive clash between Mike Brewer and David Knox in terms of, you know, line-out options and what areas of the field we ran from. And we became much more pragmatic. And we were able to grind out games. We had a very good Maul, whereas up till 2006, Munster scored a great try off a Maul. Leamy got it down in 2006. So there was areas of games where we were technically poor and weak in that we went and worked really hard on. And some of that was personnel-driven. The rest of it was actually just hard yards on the training field. And the likes of O'Driscoll and Horgan, etc., they became more aware of our need as a forward pack to, I suppose, stamp our mark on the game and opposition rather than just, you know, just be there to give them the ball.
Sorry, Wes, but like that's always fascinates me. Was there a change in the attitude of Brian O'Driscoll, Gordon Darcy, Shane Horgan, Garvin Dempsey, I suppose, was always a man who'd give everything. But like in terms of the application and intensity and hatred and all the rest of it, passion, that they brought to the blue shirt. Did it change around then because they'd had enough? Because we saw them doing it for Ireland in 2000 and whatever, from 2004 on.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't question them giving everything for Leinster, but I think that as a group, there wasn't that real, I suppose, narrow focus on Leinster. It was sometimes Leinster, you know, is great, but Ireland is bigger. And obviously, you know, Ireland is the peak, but we weren't probably as tight as a squad. And the international players sometimes maybe, you know, got an easier ride at team reviews, etc. There's maybe a them and us within the squad, and maybe the average Joes, the average provincial players in Leinster felt maybe not the same level of support or the same value as one of the international players. And I also, there's probably that realization that if we don't do something quickly, we're going to spend our career as being underachievers provincially, you know. And definitely, if you look at Horgan, Darcy, O'Driscoll, etc., the maturity they showed from 2008-09 onwards, and their level of consistency improved massively. Whereas up till then, I think we've been quite flaky. As I said, we could play on a nice sunny day against anybody, but in terms of, you know, grinding it out and a dogfight, we were often found wanting. And also, let's be honest, we recruited really well as well. I mean, you know, you look at our foreigners with Bryce Williams,
Rocky,
Cameron Jowett, Will Green in 2006. In 2009, we had Rocky Elsom, Easton Asiwa. CJ Van Linde was injured, but he was like a World Cup winning tight head. Stan Wright was a really consistent performer. So, you know, we had we'd recruited much better as well. And the branch and the powers that be gave Cheka the license to go out and get, you know, three world-class players that summer. And that was a massive help too.
Yeah. Did you feel, Wes, at the time that the cultural superiority that Munster had was just so massive that Leinster would never bridge it?
Yeah, I suppose two things Bert said there would stick out in my head. One was, you know, the way Quinny likes to tell everyone how he scored a try that saved Irish rugby against Argentina in 2003. I think Bert scored a try that saved Leinster rugby in Musgrave Park in 2008. Because if you look back, Cheka's tenure at the start, 06, they made a semi-final, ended terribly. 07, quarter-final. 08, group stage. and possibly he would have bit the dust at the end of that year. And I think that win in Musgrave Park that she got was, I don't know, from the outside looking in, seemed a big indicator of their ability to now win those tough games, which put him in good stead for 09. And then, as you say, the foreign signings, probably not dwelt on that much, but I don't think a province in Ireland has ever gone out and bought that number of that calibre of players in one swoop in the off-season, and probably hasn't done since. There's been individual signings that were as big, but to go and get three, like Rocky, Issa and Van der Linde, with the most famous big toe in Irish rugby history, but incredible, really. But I suppose we didn't kind of realise that till after the fact, because as you say, like, that was the zenith of a kind of a, maybe a 20-year run for Munster in some ways. Like, we'd played the All Blacks, obviously, in Thomond Park in November, which had opened up the new stadium. I think the famous one going around at the time was that Adidas were only making three rugby teams' jerseys around the world, which were the Lions, the All Blacks and Munster. Smashed the Ospreys in the quarterfinal leading into Leinster. Keith Earls had come on the scene, was huge excitement about him. And then we got the biggest ever haul of selections for a Lions tour just before the semi-final. And I remember staying at home from work to watch that Lions squad announcement. And I suppose when I was growing up, I was always hearing stories of how Ger Earls was never capped for Ireland because it was a bias against young Munsters and against Limerick rugby and all the rest. And then to see his barely capped, then 19-year-old son be picked on a Lions tour, there was genuinely something going off in my head going, and O'Connell obviously being the captain, the young Munster man as well, I was kind of going, this is it now. This is the app. It'll never get better than this. This is the end of almost a 20-year run where, I suppose, firstly as a Limerick man rather than a Munster man, from kind of being reared on stories of being ignored, we were now being acknowledged as kind of one of the real hotbeds of global rugby. And I kind of never thought it'd go beyond that. I thought that was as good as it gets. And when you get to that place, I suppose there's only one direction it can go from there. And it certainly went that way quickly.
And tell me, Wes, I'd forgotten. I remember covering that announcement. But did that come before the Croke Park match, just before it?
Yeah, it did. And things went down very quickly after that. The weekend just after that,
Quinny.
Well, just before that, Munster played Scarlets in a Pro 12 match, and Tomás O'Leary broke his leg, and he missed the semi final. Yes. He was playing unbelievable rugby that year. Obviously, we had stringers come in and replace him, but I think the way O'Leary was playing and what he offered in terms of his physicality at the time, he was a massive loss, and I think, more pointedly, which is harsh to say now, obviously, considering the career he's gone on to have, but Ruud de Pauke's injury was a massive loss heading into that semi-final as well. Keith Earls had to shift into the centre. He was obviously very inexperienced at the time. And I think maybe under Tony McGahan that year, you know, they kind of reached the Holy Grail in 06. They'd backed it up in 08. A bulk of them had won the Grand Slam earlier in the year in 09. I think the motivation that year wasn't about righting any wrongs or bitterness or getting one over Leinster. It was about kind of becoming an excellent team and playing a different style of rugby, and they were getting there. But I often wonder what would have happened that day if Declan Kidney was still in charge of Munster for that semi-final, you know?
Could have happened?
Well, I think Berto won't want me to bring up this, but we still dominated them in the line-out in Croke Park that day. I think O'Connell stole about six line-outs, and we had the best tactical kicker in the world playing at 10. But we kind of seemed to fall into a trap of Leinster's. Their defensive system had gotten so strong under Kirk McQuilkin that they were kind of almost daring us into playing a little bit more. And you think of Paul O'Connell trying to offload a ball over his head at one point in front of the post. You think of the first few minutes, Ian Dowling being hit late by Rocky Elsom. That goes in for a try. I still think there was a lot of, as much as Leinster almost seemed to hammer them on the day, I think there was multiple kind of swing moments that if we got a foothold in the game early, maybe Leinster's brittle confidence up to that day could have been tested a little bit more. But there was lots of big momentum shifts in the lead-up and during the game itself. And like a reverse of 06. Everything that Leinster needed to go right did, and everything that could have gone wrong for Munster did as well. It was like it was kind of written in the stars for both teams on the respective days, you know?
Well, you know what? One thing I remember was half time, it was only 10-6 from memory, and Munster, I was in a box. This was 2009, and I was in a box. I forget who invited me, but of course, delighted to go because of the tickets in Croker. And everyone was on the lash in the box, and all of the people in the box backed Munster at halftime. Munster were still favourites, even though they were 10-6 down. There was this kind of delusion that, like, this was a dream that would never end. And I just want to throw something out. I was looking at the papers on the day, and I won't name the journalist, and in fairness, he's not one of the main rugby lads, and I've written some drivel in my time as well. But have a listen to this. From the morning of the game, right? Seriously, now that we've finalised the Larne Strand Rare bookings, this is from a Munster supporter's point of view, I suppose the Croke Park business must be got through somehow. It might even prove a semi-decent warm-up for Edinburgh, though the suspicion lingers that a team with more need in the gut than Leinster might lay down a stiffer test. Liverpool would be pleased if their boot room succession model of old was still delivering Munster smooth continuity. In Leinster, Michael Checa and his Sundance farceur, David Knox, strutted into town and inherited a pretty decent, albeit soft-centred squad. What's been developed in the years since? Frankly, not much. Importing instant fix high-velt muscle isn't going to provide either a medium or long-term solution. This is for you, Bernard. Given a pack that still doesn't get the difference between want and need to win. Like, this was in the Irish Times on the morning of the game.
Yeah, look, I think, but I thought by that stage we'd kind of started to get a bit of respect as a forward pack. I remember that game, and the Wesley spoke about in Musgrave Park. I do think that game, that win, did save Checa's job. But for us as a team, it was a really dirty, wet night. And we had to ground it out. So that kind of gave us a bit of confidence. But look, we knew that. I remember walking out of Croke Park, out the tunnel. And for whatever reason, the Sky cameras stopped us. So you didn't usually get to walk out and go straight out. And we had to stop for a second. And both teams in the tunnel came up on the big screen. And the noise started to increase. And I remember just standing there and I was going to myself, look, it's now or never. If you don't perform today, you might as well retire. I mean, for Leinster people and players, you know, some more second chances. You can't have what happened to us in 2006 and 3 years later go out and do the same thing again, even if there's different people involved as a team we represent. So I do think from a mental point of view, we were at a really good place. We were massive underdogs. We've been really unimpressive in our group. We'd got an away draw, and we played in Bloodgate against Harlequins, you know, a very tight game, 6-5, rode our luck a little bit, but went into that semi-final completely under the radar. And I do agree with Wesley. I mean, Tomás O'Leary was a phenomenal form at the time, and Strings, unbelievable player, but suited our defensive system a lot more, not really having to worry about runners off nine to a certain extent. So we could get off the line a lot quicker. Tupoki was a very underrated player, which sounds crazy because, you know, in the professional game, everybody who played with or against him rates him. But he's a guy who mightn't have the kudos of a Dougie Howell or whatever. But for Munster, he was phenomenal. And in actual fact, the try we scored, that Darcy scored, we had prepped that to a certain extent. In terms of the previous 5 or 6 weeks, we played the same play consistently with a different option, and the idea was to try and lure Rua Tupoki out of the line, but we weren't sure it would work with him because he's very smart and he could make a read late. And then when Earls, if you look back on it, Earls, he jumped out of the line because he'd seen the picture before, and that left a hole for Nasiwa. Like, again, you know, there's no guarantee that as I said, Rua Tupoki, much more experienced defender at 13, the plan was to try and lure him out. But you just wonder, you know, if he would have been as impulsive as Keith was, you know, given his inexperience there. We also, it wasn't for a try, but we got a penalty off it. actually that Johnny Sexton kicked because Felipe did his knee in the when we were playing advantage. We played a play that Rocky Elson made a break off a lineout as well, which again got us from the halfway into the Munster 22. And actually, I think Felipe got a drop goal off it maybe, but it just making line breaks against Munster with plays that we planned, but to make two line breaks, one of them turned into a try, one turned into 3 points, gave us kind of momentum. And then little offloads of Munster tried that it wouldn't have tried before, kind of kept us with energy and confidence. And, you know, obviously the Driscoll try, you know, pulls the game away. But if you look at the last 20 minutes, Munster didn't lie down after that. Munster threw everything at us, but we counter-rooked once on our own line, got a turnover. You know, we managed to defend really well. But I do think, I agree with Wesley. I mean, McGahan was trying to evolve Munster's game. And given kind of how our defence had improved and our attitudes had improved, it probably played into our hands to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, and Jesus, you think back to Butch James drop goal and all the rest of it. But I, and this is speculation, but like if I don't know, is it even worth going down there? But if Munster had won that day, would we have had the Leinster like that is now the with Saracens, and of course the Saracens asterisk mark probably makes it no longer a moot point. Leinster are the team of the decade.
Okay, in theory, yes, Leinster should still be the force they are in Europe. But I think that, you know, Leinster probably don't go for Joe Schmidt after Michael Cechia because he's a gamble. You know, the team maybe breaks up and you make a bad decision coach-wise. Who knows? I mean, there's lots of teams who should be successful that aren't necessarily successful. So I do think it was a key game for Leinster to win.
Yeah, I mean, like, look at, like, you know, it is nostalgic now, but they were mighty days. I mean, the days out. And the other thing about it, I suppose, was were you in any way aware, Bernard, that there might be a repeat in terms of the red domination of the stadium? And was it a huge boost when you walked out to see that it was 50-50 or better from a blue point of view?
Yeah, I remember we got a bus from the hotel to Croke Park, police escort. And, I mean, from the mile and a half between the stadium and where we were, you could sense that there was a far greater percentage of Leinster fans there than had been in 2006. I don't think it was 50-50 on the day, probably 60-40, but there were certainly a lot more people who weren't shy about wearing blue. For us, that gave us a little bit of confidence that we were on the right track and that our own people weren't embarrassed to follow us, really. And that's, like, it wasn't, like, we hadn't built a close unity with them because, as I said, and I don't blame the fans at all. It was on us as players to do enough to gain the respect. And what, you know, the Munster thing, and it's not about winning trophies. Like, if you look at pre-2006, Munster hadn't won any European trophies. But when they lost, they went down in a certain manner. And there was an honesty and consistency about it. So, like, I used to get annoyed internally in Leinster when, as players, we criticised Leinsters, etc. Because my point of view would have been, look, you got to give them something to follow and you got to earn that respect. And up till 2009, Munster had done that in a far better way than us. And so, again, you know, it was a sign that we were changing things, but it came down to us at the end of the day. Whoever represented Leinster needed to make sure that people were proud to follow them. And it's not just, as I said, it's not just about trophies. Obviously, that's the easy thing to look at. But you look at some hardcore fans of teams who never win, but they believe in their team because they feel like they're doing their best on a consistent basis. And we hadn't really earned that. And 2009 was the start of that. And obviously, the team that plays now every week is a phenomenal example of being consistent and giving your fans something to be proud of.
Yeah, Wes, I suppose it's an oversimplification, but if you look at the connection that Munster forged with the supporters from the late 90s on, it reflected what people like to see about themselves, their kind of sense of sacrifice and honesty and hardship and, you know, really, really busting a gut, whereas, like, Leinster were ghettoised as a kind of a South County Dublin team in people's minds. I know that isn't fair, but it suddenly kind of it changed then that yeah, Leinster represented all of the values that people like in teams in sport and in teams that they support.
It's like Bert was saying there, though. I mean, I think the most frustrating thing about Leinster and the thing that maybe made people dislike them was that the talent was so obvious and the application wasn't there. Whereas with Munster, you know, you got everything you wanted to see from them, except the result maybe sometimes, as weird as that sounds, but the manner in which they went down was great. But I think going back to that article you read, it's funny that he talks about the difference between need and want, and Leinster not knowing that at the time. But I think that day, again, from the outside looking in, I mean, there's no doubt Munster were desperate to win. But I think, as Bernard said, I always thought, like, if you were a Leinster player at the time, where had you to go if you imploded again? And that then, like, I was actually surprised at the amount of support they had in 09. I didn't think there was that many of them, to be honest. But I suppose I was always curious. I'd be interested what Bernard has to say in terms of what was the mentality within the dressing room in terms of the division between, were you focused on, I mean, you mentioned two set moves, you know, a lot of detail built into your game plan, but how much of it was just pure almost spite at that stage, that you were sick of watching Munster take all these plaudits and kudos and you just wanted to get out there and smash them?
Yeah, no, that was the most part of it, to be honest. I mean, the game plan wasn't as relevant as physically, and I'm surprised there wasn't a massive dust up after 5 or 10 minutes. And looking back on it yesterday,
there was one with Shaggy and O'Connell. Do you remember?
It didn't get overheated, which I'm surprised. I think our mindset was, look, if there's a row, we need to be instigating it rather than being peacemakers. Do you know what I mean? And it just never got that heated, which is amazing given the hype. And if you look, I look back in 2006 again, and there's little individuals from Munster pushing and shoving Leinster players that probably shouldn't have been tolerated, but like never, no one from Leinster or collectively from Leinster. Felipe tried to obviously deal with Leamy on his own, got pinged. But again, that should be a collective thing. And I think for us, definitely, as well, 100%, we were ready for war and thought there would be war. Now, the way the game unfolded, it kind of didn't come down to that. But I think when you have that mindset that you're ready for it, it can sometimes let the other stuff just flows naturally. But certainly for us, we didn't think the game would be won on game plan. We thought the game would be won, you know, defending pick and goals, defending maul, set piece, aggression, breakdown. They were the things that we would have said, if you want to beat Munster, you have to get the edge there. Kicking game had to be really smart. But it didn't really come down to that, which is kind of the way the game unfolded and kind of the way Munster were trying, as you said, to evolve their game. And there's no reason, look at, it's easy with hindsight to go, look at, European Cup semi-finals aren't the days to against your provincial or national rivals to go out and try and show how good you are as a player and the wit you play with. But I can see why Tony McGann and the Munster coaches wouldn't have seen any need to go away from that, because that was the journey they were on and it was all working perfectly. If you look back at like the Ospreys quarterfinal, I mean, Munster won that pulling up, whereas previously, the previous game plan meant you might win that game by 2 or 3 points. Do you know what I mean? They were by playing a more expansive game, they were able to, I suppose, pull away and win games easier when the opposition couldn't stand up to you. Whereas maybe we had enough power or balance to be able to stand up to them and defend that type of game. But where maybe we were weaker or we weren't tested on the day was that kind of, you know, very abrasive, in your face, you know, high continuity game.
Even that year, there have been two previous games that Munster won 18-0 in the RDS in September, October. Justin Milk, I remember, a short-term signing, got a lovely offload to Keith Earls, I think, for the try. And then only 3 weeks, I think, before the semi-final, Munster won, I think, 22-5 in Thomond Park, and Contepomi'd had another meltdown.
Yeah.
But when you looked at the quality in the Leinster team, and both of those games, even though they seemed like big wins, they were actually quite tight for 50, 60 minutes, and Munster pulled away at the end. So I was reading an article from David Wallace yesterday, looking back at 09, and it was the exact way I felt as a supporter watching it, but it was something the whole week that I was just uneasy about, that it just had ambush written all over it. You just had the sense Leinster absolutely had to perform and had the talent to perform if they got it right.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I remember those two games that we'd lost, but we felt the scoreline didn't reflect kind of the difference between the two teams. And as a four-pack, we kind of felt we were getting closer and closer to being able to match Munster. So, yeah, we went, as I said, it suited us to a certain extent going in under the radar. And look, in sport, your mental state of mind and being really aware of what's coming is massive. And I look back, and just, you see, after we scored points and tries, you look at the Munster players behind the posts. I mean, there's different people talking. You can see that shock on their face. And again, look, we got ahead of them. That was the key. If Munster went ahead of us, you know, would we have been able to get back ahead of them? But we got the lead on the scoreboard. And at that stage, we had enough of better defence that we believed in and trusted it. And that became, that, you know, and the other try was Luke Fitzgerald, you know, skinning Warwick as well. I mean, you know, that was a situation where nine times out of ten.
He never played well against Leinster, Paul Warwick, after that.
We talked about that and tried to, I suppose, target him to a certain extent. But, like, on another day, Luke Fitzgerald's putting a touch there. You know what I mean? But on that day, you know, it's a try and it looks like we're playing brilliant rugby. But that was probably the first time we kind of went through the hands, really, in the whole game.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable looking back at the 06 and 09 and looking at the quarterfinals were so relevant now again from 14 years out. Like, Munster really just grinding it out against Perpignan in 06 and Leinster turning it on with that fabulous Dennis Hickey try, etc., against Toulouse. And yet the semi-final going the other way and you just getting the 6-5 Bloodgate win where Butch James could have had that drop goal to put you out and Munster putting together the complete performance of the era against the Ospreys, who were bloody good at that stage. And yet when he went into a semi-final, it was almost as if it was counterproductive to have had the better form in the quarters.
Yeah, absolutely. And that builds... It's very hard for players, and I think Kidney, as Wesley said, he would have been all over that. I mean, part of his genius is the mental side of it, and I suppose being able to spot a potential backlash or spot a bit of complacency, and I think he would be more aware of it. But it is very hard to convince yourself, you know, if you're a Munster player, like we probably fell into that trap in 2006. That it's not going to be a great day, and it's not going to be a day that you reinforce how much better you are than your biggest rival. And you know, and on certain days the opposition crack, and that day we thankfully, you know, put in a decent performance and got a lot of the breaks that we needed to get and got a win.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt, Wes, there were the two games that stand out from the whole kind of voyage from both the Munster and Leinster supporter point of view, and it's frightening to think that they were that long ago. But I mean, they do deserve to stand on their own, and look, the perfect symmetry as well, one win each. But
it'd be great.
That was the decade.
It'd be great, Dara, to get back to those days again, where both are genuine, you know, European contenders, and we have that massive.
Getting his own back now. Here, he's trying to have a few little things now here.
No, but at the moment, obviously, it's been a bit one way with Leinster. I know Munster have got to, you know, go through semi-finals, etc. But look, I think it's great for Irish rugby. I think the great days. It was a great day. Great day to be part of. In one sense, in 2009, very bad day in 2006. But I think it would be great to have a very strong provincial game again, where, you know, we genuinely have hopefully three teams. Who can win Europe. And now, who knows, coming out of this COVID-19 crisis with what's happening in Saracens, you know, why we can't get two or three teams back at the top in Europe again.
Yeah, I don't want to be. I love the idea of that, but I just feel, and again, maybe it's just having lived through it and being an old fart, is that like the status and the stature of the Heineken Cup was so different then. I mean, it was just like arguably for dyed in the wool Irish supporters as well. It was as important, if not more important. Whereas it has slipped back slightly in the ecosystem now, for a number of reasons. But it just seems to be they were the glory days of the tournament, and I think we can all agree that Munster played their part in making it such an amazing tournament, and then Leinster grabbed it from them and finished off the job. But like, is the Heineken Cup 2020-2021 the same as it was 2006, 2004, 2009, 2011?
No, unfortunately, it's lost its value, I think, to a certain extent. Not value in terms of it's still very hard to win, but it just doesn't seem to capture the fans' imagination, or there's less of a sense of journey or destiny to it. I feel anyway. I think it's devalued as a competition, or it's gone backwards.
There may be a World Cup semi-final, which we won't even get into all that, but it's hard to see any rugby game kind of grabbing the general public the way both of those did at this point in time, I think. There was still a bit of a novelty about it. There was kind of the almost All-Ireland aspect of it. I don't know, I just, right now it's hard to see. Not to say I can't in the future, but right now I think if Munster and Leinster met in a semi-final or a final, I don't think it would actually captivate people the way it did then. I mean, I was kind of still a fan in 06. I started working in RTE that summer after it, and I was just consumed by it. It was like literally your every waking thought, mine anyway, was about would Munster win that game leading up to that semi-final, the first one. Less so in 09 probably. I was actually cutting the highlights of the game for RTE's coverage that night at that stage, trying not to vomit while I did it. But no, I don't think it'll ever capture it. I don't think it will capture it again right now. That's not to say it will in the future. But I didn't think it was the turning point it would prove to be. I thought, you know, Munster will come back strongly the next year. And of course, then the next year there was that 36-0 or whatever at the RDS. And it was really the Good Friday game in Tolman later that year when Leinster not only won in Limerick, but had won back-to-back fixtures that I kind of went, right, well, hands down they are now definitely the better side. But I think the bulk of that Munster team had kind of emptied themselves so much physically and mentally chasing the Heineken Cup in 06, backed it up in 08, 8 or 9 of them then won a Grand Slam, which was another Holy Grail. Then so many of them went on a Lions tour that extended that season. I think it just took a huge amount of energy out of the stalwart to that team, the John Hayes, the David Wallace, people like that. Jerry Flannery was never right with injury after that. Wally wasn't. Leamy was starting to get a lot of injuries. I think, in hindsight, that was kind of the end of the road. And I suppose if they had held on that day in Croke Park to be the first team to win two Heineken's back-to-back, to won 3 in 4 years, to been the first team to do a Pro 12 Heineken Cup double, I think that would have kind of cemented their place as the best team we'd seen in European competition up to that point. And even now, we would still have three European Cups, the same as Leinster, whereas, you know, now it looks like Leinster have just streaked clear. And I suppose that's a win that day, and to win the tournament that year would have bought us maybe relief for the next 10 years, whereas now we've just been very much put in the pocket by Leinster over the last number of years. So I'd imagine for a lot of the players, or for the likes of Gareth Fitzgerald, God rest him, I'd say that day was a massive, massive regret, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it is, but it was like the journey. Like, just personally, when I think about it, it just absolutely, from a fan, as you were saying, Wes, I only kind of got back into rugby through that Munster thing. I mean, I'd grown up following, obviously, Munster and schools rugby and Ireland, but I lost my grow for it in the 90s, I have to say. As a supporter, I was getting my buzz from hurling and from kind of Cork going well in the hurling and not even Cork, but the whole Clare Wexford thing in the 90s. And there seemed to be some... That was where it was. That was where the soul of Ireland was in the 90s. And it just seamlessly kind of transferred into the whole Munster journey at the beginning of the 2000s. And it was fantastic. And it came to an end, I think, that day. What is it? I remember just turning 40. So was it the very beginning of April? The very end of April 2009. I think it was end of an era. End of an era.
Or just trying to hold back the laughing now here at your pain. So
don't I'm sure they're
feeling nostalgic about it.
No, look at it. I appreciate it. It's a great time for memories. But we gotta move on. Day jobs and so forth.
All right. Well, on that, I suppose if anyone has enjoyed listening to this, they can make suggestions or tweet us at RTE Rugby on other games that changed Irish rugby, and we can drag out a few observers like Wes and myself, and drag out a few protagonists like Bernard and others, and go through them. We could be doing worse things as we have our lockdown, lads.
Absolutely. Yeah. Always good to look back.
All right, fellas. Listen, thanks for that. Thanks, Wesley Liddy. Thanks, Bernard Jackman.
Thanks, William. All right, lads.